The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Cool Zone Media.
Hello, and welcome to Cool People Who Built a Militant Popular Social Movement and Faced Severe State Repression and Therefore Splintered into a Reformist Wing that Failed, as well as a More Clandestine Wing that Also Failed but Still Changed the Course of History. Weekly podcast that does exactly what it says in the title, almost every week. I'm your host, Margaret Kildroy. Boy. And with me today, as my guest, is, see if I can get this right, Robert Evans, host of the podcast Derrière la Salude.
Yeah,
a podcast that focuses on all the bad people in French history. Did I get that right?
Yeah, all of that's perfect. I continue to be amazed that the Apple people let that title into iTunes or whatever tunes they use these days. But I guess they knew brilliance when they saw it.
Yeah, clearly. Because they didn't, well, or they were, you know, just actually spoke French and didn't realize that derrière had a different meaning in English.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I think that's probably what happened.
What are we hearing about today, Magpie?
Well, you ever had a piece of technology that you just couldn't stand? One that made you, dare I say it, feel like a bit of a Luddite?
Yes. Everything that is more recent than about 2012. With the exception, what I'll say, this shows you how badly Star Trek The Next Generation hacked my brain. Anything that's like a cool screen, like a folding screen or a transparent screen, I'm still on board with. I love a cool screen. I can't get past that part of growing up on TNG. But yeah, self-driving cars, no thank you. AI, anything, no fucking thank you. I can't even really get on board with the TikToks.
I know, I'm like annoyed that I'm so actively annoyed that they're trying to ban it. Because
yeah.
Because I also don't want to use it. But what I do want to do is remember to do the rest of my introduction, including introducing our producer, Sophie. Hi, Sophie.
Hi. Robert doesn't know how to use most technology, but yet knows how to report on it. It's really fun for me.
Yeah.
His business
kind
partner.
Kind of impressive.
Uh-huh.
I can't even tell you the amount of times I've explained things to him and went, but you started as a tech journalist. What are you talking about? How can you not do basic human thing? And Robert's like, I don't know. Let me tell you about something nobody's ever heard of and explain it perfectly.
I mean, some of it is that like Abe Simpson saying, it'll happen to you.
It'll happen to you.
Because like my dad was an early adopter. He like didn't have a ton of money and he spent all of it on computers, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that was my dad as well, actually.
Yeah.
Or more than he should have, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And no, doesn't, I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, but I'm starting to hit that point myself. I was like explaining computer things to my dad, and now I'm like, you know, one of my friends like takes the remote away from me while I'm trying to navigate the YouTube menu, and it's like, give it to me, grandma.
Uh-huh, yeah, Garrison gives me no end of shit because I love having motion smoothing on.
Jesus Christ.
Well, it's the most boomer thing I've ever said.
Yeah, it was really upsetting. None of us would be anywhere with technology without our wonderful editor. And who is he? Mm-hmm.
Daniel. That was a really good transition.
It's almost like I'm a professional.
Weird. Yeah, someone should actually pay you at this point.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, we should get on that. Daniel is our audio editor. Everyone says hi to Daniel. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
Our theme music was written for us by Unwoman. All right, so follow-up question. You have the technology that makes you feel like a bit of a Luddite. What's your take on Industrial Revolution and its consequences for humanity?
You know, consequences is such a big word. And to be honest, I don't think you can really... We're still waiting to see, are we going to pull out of this climate tailspin that we are currently in before it kills everything of value on the planet? And
question.
I think until we get the final answer to that, we won't be able to say for sure, because there's obviously a lot of horrible downsides, you know, yeah. Fucking sweatshops and industrial war and shit. But there's also like labor saving devices. There's God knows how many people have had a chance to explore themselves, art, creativity, just spend more time, you know, with their family because of labor saving devices. So I'm gonna say like this is still a neck and neck fight right now. Like we'll see who hits the finish line first.
Okay. I feel like one team called climate change has pulled out ahead.
Yes. Look, is that the best odds you're gonna get right now? Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But I would put words in your mouth and say that appropriate technology is a beautiful thing and a worthwhile thing.
Yeah, it certainly can be.
And so sometimes people assume that to be a Luddite is to be against all technology, and that the people fighting against the Industrial Revolution were against the idea of making life better. And today, we're going to talk about them. We're going to talk about the Luddites.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah.
You know much about the Luddites?
I know that they were skilled workers mainly in the garment industry, like weaving and shit like that, which is just having done one part of that, like shearing the animal part of it. It's the whole, like the amount of human labor before we developed the machines we've developed was titanic. And my understanding is a lot of them did not like that these machines were coming in, at least certain types of the machines that came in to automate this process, because they turned it from a skilled trade where the people doing it were valuable and had some leverage because you needed it done and only a certain number of people knew how to do it, to something that where they were all just kind of slotted in like little machines themselves, right? And they viewed it as like reducing the dignity and of labor, among other problems.
Yeah, I would say that that's a good overall look at the Luddites and what they were doing, is that they were opposed to what the machines were doing rather than like, that thing has too many spinning wheels.
Yeah, the issue isn't I don't like machines because they do things better. It's I don't like the way these machines are being used to turn us into machines.
Right. And also, interestingly, a lot of people are really proud of their work. And some of these machines, not all of them, but some of these machines were absolutely turning out junk, were turning out inferior quality work.
Oh, interesting. I wonder if that's going to ever happen again.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure. I actually don't think that this has any reflection. This is a very in the past, no modern. Okay, well, I'll just get into it.
Yeah.
In 1811, during the middle of the Industrial Revolution, a bunch of textile workers in northern England came together to fight against the mechanization of their industry. Labor organizing had been outlawed, so this didn't stop them. They formed a secret society, and they went about smashing machines with hammers, burning down factories, and occasionally shooting back at the owners who were shooting and killing them on a regular basis. A bunch of them were men wearing dresses.
Love to see it. I mean, it's efficient.
It is, yeah. You all that room to move, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I go hiking all the time in long skirts, and people are like, what are you doing? That's going to catch on things. And just like, I've been doing this for a very long time.
When you're doing a lot of hallucinogens, you learn the best way to do certain things. And that's how I realized that the most efficient kind of dress was like a slightly longer than ankle length skirt.
Yeah.
Like dress in terms of clothing. Yeah.
No,
great
totally.
Stuff. Yeah.
A maxi skirt is the finest thing. It's pajamas you can wear all day.
It's easy to make, too. I used to make my own skirts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually the only thing I used to be able to sew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not a great sewer. Just that.
So these Luddites pushed England right to the brink of outright revolution. The other thing that I didn't realize coming into this was just how big of a deal the Luddite rebellion was. The government decided to declare its loyalty with the owners and not the people. Soldiers put down the uprising quite violently. A bunch of people were hanged. A bunch of people were deported to Australia. And the Luddite rebellion was quelled. Its songs and its name live on, though mostly, sadly, are quite horribly misrepresented.
Yeah.
There's a few mainstream narratives available about our friends, the Luddites. The first, of course, is the simplistic version. Some people didn't like technology, so they smashed up machines because they hated change.
Sure.
And then if you're going galaxy brain chart, next up is the more historically informed one. The Luddites didn't hate technology as a concept. They hated the automation of their jobs that robbed them of employment, like kind of like cashiers mad at self-checkout lines or something.
Sure.
You can keep going higher up. You get to kind of, you know, it's not that the Luddites had one job in a factory and suddenly had a different job in a factory. It's that they didn't have a factory job at all. They had a job as an artisan, right?
Yeah.
And the Luddite rebellion is positioned in the midst of the Industrial Revolution, and it was a revolt by those used to artisan skilled labor and a life with some level of dignity, and as you pointed out, some level of bargaining power, right?
Yeah.
And from this point of view, it is a revolt against the modern world. It is a revolt against what future friend of the pod, William Blake, only 7 years earlier had called the dark satanic mills of industry that were cropping up.
Mm. Okay, but that kind of makes them sound cool, too.
I know. This is one of the problems. When you hang out mostly in history books from like the early 1800s, a lot of people saying really cool radical stuff are framing it theologically. And so they're like confusing my like metalhead conception of what makes something cool, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Because if like somebody was like, hey, I'm opened up like an occult themed like wool clothes shop, would you donate some of your wool to the dark satanic loom or whatever? I'd be like, yeah, absolutely. That sounds based.
Totally.
Yeah, let's do it.
And so most of the time, people who see these underlying issues still see the Luddites as like, at best, hopeless romantics who couldn't handle the changing of industry. Mm-hmm. Like the whalers who lost their job when lighting moved away from whale oil and towards petroleum, or the coal miners in Appalachia currently facing the decline of their industry, right? And so it's this narrative of progress and these people who are like tragically left behind. I don't buy that narrative. I will present the Industrial Revolution not as a benign or neutral thing, but instead the birth of capitalism and industrial production that are, again, I'm guessing, are going to have irrevocable danger to all of humanity in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They were not a tiny group doing an isolated rebellion. I want to position them as revolutionists in the middle of a decentralized global uprising in defense of the commons. And did you know that it started with a comet in the sky?
Most good things do, right?
Yeah. Like, I think that I guess there's the Bible star thing, mm-hmm. but I think overall, if you read like classic works of literature and there's like the omen of the comet in the sky.
Yeah.
The comet of 1811, I think, is where that comes from.
Okay.
For 260 days, from March 1811 to January 1812, a massive comet held court in the heavens. Its tail was stretched out for everyone to see, everyone in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
The Great Comet of 1811, it found its way into the writings of Tolstoy and Victor Hugo and William Blake. Tolstoy wasn't alive yet, but it ends up in his writings.
Sure.
And it was seen as a portent all over the world by all kinds of uprisings. Mostly, people were like, you think the world's ending? And everyone's like, pretty sure.
Yeah.
Pretty sure the world's ending.
I think there's another thing psychologically going on here, too. And I just say this because of like how I tend to interpret some of the things that I've experienced in my life that I could see as supernatural or whatever, which is that most people who recognize that like something is fucked up and they need to do something about all the fucked up shit are also like, but I don't want to like die or, you know, sacrifice my life or whatever. And you're kind of looking for an excuse that like, okay, it's the time to act. And anything that happens that's weird is like, well, shit, I guess it was that, right? Like, that's as good as I've been looking for an excuse to start, you know, the process of fighting back. And I guess this comet's as good as any.
Honestly, that makes a lot of sense to me. Because it's like, they knew it was a comet.
Yeah. Right?
Like, they had astronomy and stuff, mm-hmm. you know? It still meant a lot to them, symbolically.
Yeah. It makes sense to me.
And there were a lot of uprisings in 1811 and 1812.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them used very consciously the language of defending the commons. Some of them didn't, but all of them, well, all the ones that I'm going to talk about, were fighting for a way of life that hadn't been defined by capitalism, colonialism, or the great enclosures of the commons. To talk about the commons, I talk about the commons reasonably often, but I think this is like one of the more important concepts to understand where we're at now is... In short, in a lot of cultures, but most notably medieval England, because they managed to export culture and language all over the world through power process of domination, you had the, what was known as the commons, and the idea that most of the land was just kind of publicly owned. Like, well, why would you own that? It's not your house or yard. Of course, people can just go collect firewood, hunt, graze sheep, maybe grow some potatoes. It's land. Use it like land. Everyone can use it. It's land. It's the commons. Mm-hmm. And then you get the enclosure of the commons, which was the privatization of it, which was literal and direct. And England was carved up by stone fences, hedgerows, and ditches, dividing everything up. I like, whenever you see like an old movie and it's like medieval England and someone like runs through a hedge along the side of the road, it makes me feel like that couldn't be real, right?
Yeah.
But that actually... was. That was what was happening by late medieval England.
Wow. Yeah, I guess the last gasp of it is here out on the West Coast, you have a shitload more BLM land.
Yeah.
Like out in Oregon and Washington and even big chunks of California, you regularly find yourself in these vast tracts of land that's just like, well, this is all of ours, right? Like, it's still kind of the last gasp of that attitude, I guess, because white people haven't been here as long.
Yeah. No, totally. The public lands in the U.S. are a really interesting. And BLM is like more directly just used as like, I don't know, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know. And so this enclosure started in the medieval period and just kept ramping up through the 19th century. We've talked a bunch about the 17th century anti-enclosure rebels. If people want to hear more about it, go listen to the episode about the diggers, the levelers, and the ranters. And then the Industrial Revolution kicked off, and everything got more enclosure-y. By the end of the 18th century, by like the 1790s or so, things are really fucking heated in this way. In the 1790s, there were 25 parliamentary enclosure acts in England. By 1811, there were 133.
Jeez.
And the enclosure wasn't just of land. Everything suddenly had to be discreet, like with the T in between the two E's, and regimented. Rivers became canals. Language became more codified. You started getting like dictionaries and lexicons published, which overall, like, I'm not inherently against that, right?
No.
Alongside of that, press censorship went up.
Yeah.
Class divisions became even more pronounced, which I totally don't entirely understand because England's like one of the most class divided places in the world, you know?
Yeah.
They speak a different language from each other, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
At this point, during the enclosure of the commons, the word common takes on its negative connotations. Soldiers start living in separate, they start living separate from everyone else, housed in barracks. The prison industrial complex kicks in. Prisons are being built everywhere. Prisoners are doing a lot of the labor for building this infrastructure in England. England became famous and actually mocked for building so many barracks and prisons. Like, what the hell's wrong with these people?
Mm-hmm.
The enclosure also came for gender. To quote author Peter Linebaum, quote, "The household became part of the system of enclosure. The genders were separated by doctrine of the two spheres, the private sphere for women and the public sphere for men. The wife ceased to have a legal persona or existence."
Yeah.
And prior to the Industrial Revolution, most manufacturing was done by artisans working at home or in small workshops, which is now... Mm. Called kind of disparagingly a cottage industry, right? These cottages became factories, and this was a way more efficient way to speed up the process of destroying the Earth's atmosphere. And it was also a substantial decrease in quality of life for the individual producers.
Yeah.
It also had like some positive knock-on effects, right? Like if you ever read about how long it took to make cloth back in the day with hand spinning and weaving. Like, that was your life.
Yeah. I mean, that is, there's a really good a historian who does like a blog kind of analyzing myths about classical civilizations. He did a multi-piece one on the Spartans, trying to talk about like how oppressed the Helots were. And one of the things he goes into is, if you are a woman in a family, most of your life is making and maintaining clothing for your family.
Yeah.
And not to have multiple outfits, just to be able, because you're wearing them every day, they're getting worn by outside work.
Yeah.
And when you're taxing, you know, half or what, like it's like 80 hours a week for a lot of people, for basically your whole life, like maintaining 40 to 80 hours a week, depending, you know, on a couple of things, maintaining and whatnot clothing for your family. Like, it is like a nightmare burden.
Yeah. No, yeah, I remember reading once that it was like to make a square yard of linen was about a week's worth of labor for someone who knew what they were doing.
There are very few people alive today who do anything as hard as maintaining clothing for a family back in like that period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's what's so frustrating, right? He's like, well, I love my dishwasher, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's great.
The
time I don't, and I didn't have one until I was, you know, in my late 30s, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, and I was like, well, I don't need one. I'll just wash dishes. That's meditative. I love that I just like rinse off my dishes, throw them in the dishwasher. Like,
yeah.
No, it is. It's, and this is what's so frustrating, because, yeah, it's very natural to look at this and be like, well, I don't want to go back to everyone having to hand weave everything, right?
Of course not. I would just freeze to death.
The very first factories of the Industrial Revolution were textile factories, producing the cloth that got sent out to the various cottages. So that was the first part to be industrialized.
Yeah.
Textile was big business in England. It was the largest industry in England. 1 million people, around 10% of the country, was involved in the wool industry alone. Then cotton started coming in from India and the US, and that was even easier to work. You get your first textile machine, the stocking frame, invented in 1589. People of all genders wore stockings and not pants, and this was made of knitted wool. And so this was a way of automating, or at least incredibly speeding up that process. The queen was like, if you patent that, it'll fuck over all the poor people.
Yeah.
You know, it'll trash our economy. So she didn't let it be patented. And during the chunks of the medieval period, you have this thing in England that you still see today, where the crown is seen as what protects the commoners from like poverty and the non-noble rich, you know, what later becomes the capitalist class. But slowly, surely, knitting was automated.
I mean, that makes sense to me, like the role of the, because if you're the queen or the king or whatever, you're on top of your social hierarchy. Everyone below them is constantly jockeying and fighting for power and influence. And the primary way to do that is by finding new ways to fuck over the poor. Whereas if you're on top, you're not jockeying for power over the others, but you do always have to keep an eye on, like, are the poor pissed off enough that they might kill us all? Right? Yeah. So you're the only one that is really focused on that.
No, you're right. That is such a good point. That is where you're... Your
Have
primary
we gone
interest.
Too far yet?
Yeah. But you know what doesn't go too far, except some of the ads we've been getting lately.
Except
that
occasionally.
Canceled.
Yes, yes.
The other ads that aren't in support of genocidal regimes or becoming jailers. Don't do either of those two things.
That's right.
But anything else that's being sold, you should buy it.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Mm-hmm. I feel bad, Margaret, because you said jailer, and I forgot to immediately respond. Jailer? I hardly know her. That's my bit.
Yeah,
I do it with a lot of stuff.
It's a good bit. It's pretty
Jesus
original.
It's great.
Sophie loves it. Sophie loves that I do it anytime someone says anything with an ER at the end.
Yeah. That's Robert. I barely know air.
Perfect. It always hits.
Don't encourage this, Magpie.
Sorry. By the mid-1700s, you've got what's called a spinning jenny, which automates a lot of yarn spinning. Mm-hmm. The inventor saw this machine smashed in front of him and he had to flee town.
Yeah. I'm thinking back to when those local youths in Oakland destroyed that self-driving car the other week.
Oh, hell yeah. I haven't seen this yet.
Lit it on fire.
Yeah. Good. And it's not that the concept of a car that drives itself is inherently bad, but within the system that we live in, it's going to drive you to jail.
It's going to take money from poor people and give all of it to the same four guys who are already taking money from poor people. Like, that is the issue.
Exactly. And that is what is happening here with industrialization. Yeah. They're not like, a lot of people at this point are using machines for their work and they've found ways to be skilled laborers using these machines.
Right? Yeah. I know a lot of people who get wool either from their own animals or from other people's animals and spin it and use it to make clothing. And they don't have to spend 80 hours a week to barely maintain one guard because they use modern tools to do all that. They just are also artisans.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so soon enough, the spinning jenny is attached to a water wheel. And then you get the steam engine. And suddenly, because you have a steam engine, you have way more coal mines. And then you have to build canals to connect them all with convict labor. And there's factories with smokestacks all over the countryside. And who worked the factories? Well, it's fucking England, so it's children.
Mm-hmm.
As young as 6 years old, 2/3 of the workers in these early factories were children, especially orphans hired out, essentially slave labor, hired from orphanages and workhouses.
Yeah.
And so people were like, we don't like this. And later people were like, oh, they clearly just hate not working all the time. They're like, no, the smokestacks, the just child slavery, anyway.
Yeah, we don't really know what cancer is, but we're pretty sure this is causing it.
Yeah, we shouldn't be breathing this. That's all I know. So the commons are enclosed and people start seeing their way of life disappear and their quality of life drop dramatically. And they didn't accept it. They fought back. Sometimes they did it chaotically. Sometimes they did it in an organized fashion. And they did this all over the world. I hate to give the U.S. Revolution much credit. If you've heard any other episode, it's just me talking shit on the U.S. Revolution. But it really did change the world. Mm-hmm. And this wave of republicanism spread over Europe, inspiring the French Revolution soon after. And people started being like, hey, what if we had, like, rights? Like, what if... like, what an idea, you know? And by 1792, you have the London Corresponding Society, which is one of the first working class organizations. It is basically a proto-trade union. It was started by a shoemaker and some buds. It was open to everyone, and it fought for democracy. So, the government passed the Combination Acts that made union organizing illegal. And one thing we've seen time and time again is that if you make union organizing illegal, people don't sit down and shut up. They start sabotaging things and firing guns.
Yeah. You have taken the option of them to fight without destroying your property or your body. So they're going to do one of those two things.
Right. And they usually even start with just property. And the Luddites are an absolute example of this.
Yeah.
Thomas Hardy was the shoemaker that helped found that organization.
Well, I know who we cast for that guy if we're making a movie about this.
Oh, I don't know.
Tom Hardy.
Oh, wait. Oh, okay. I don't know any. Yep. Okay. That's an actor.
That's Mad Max in Fury Road.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
He can do this job. Sure.
I think sometimes people were like, oh, Margaret doesn't know any pop culture references. I watch a ton of movies and TV. I'm just face blind and don't remember names.
That's fine.
So Thomas Hardy from Mad Max is saved by the work of a man who is often called the first anarchist in Western society, William Godwin. He comes way before Proudhon, and he's way less of a dick.
Yeah.
Because there's this clique of aristocracy around this time, connected with the Romantic poets, who are going to fight hard and at personal expense and risk for the working class, including fighting for the Luddites. One day, I'm going to do this whole episode where I talk about William Godwin and his wife Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote one of the foundational feminist books, and they had a kid named Mary Shelley, who invented science fiction, who married Percy Shelley, the Romantic poet and upstart. But that'll be another episode. Although most of those characters are going to come in today because they're all part of the Luddite shit in some weird way. So Godwin puts pressure on, is like, uses the fact that he's like a rich bastard or whatever. To put pressure and be like, hey, maybe don't hang a guy for starting a working men's association. Maybe that's going to cause some trouble. And people are fighting back because people are always fighting back. And one of the people who fought back was this kid who probably didn't exist. And his name's Ned Ludd.
Yeah.
He's a Robin Hood figure, partly in that he probably didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But it's 1779, according to most versions of this story. And you've got this kid named Edward Ludd, who lives in the Midlands in England. And he's apprentice. He's learning the knitting frame. And he has a shitty boss. Sometimes it's his dad. And he's not so sure that doing the same repetitive motion his entire life is like his best plan. And he's a bit of a slacker. So he's whipped for slacking. So he gets a big old hammer. He smashes up the machine. And he fucking takes off to Sherwood Forest because this happens in fucking Nottingham.
Yeah, I mean, this is very familiar, though. Sophie and I have dealt with a very similar labor problem here at Cool Zone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that's
that
why
you all...
Garrison's not allowed a hammer anymore.
Yeah, and is only allowed in the forest, is living in the forest.
Yes, that was happening before as well, but...
Oh, okay. So young Gare disappears into legend or is entirely made up and is sort of the paragon of machine smashing.
Mm-hmm.
By 1802, you've got another machine smashing that we can say isn't legend. There's been a bunch of machine smashings before this. Oh, there's actually this thing. It didn't make it in my script, but I had this conversation with a friend of mine who's like a historian who knows a lot about like the revolutions of 1848 and the birth of socialism and all this stuff. And he was telling me about how the old heads, the old Luddites, when they're like showing up to the 1848 revolution, they're like, ah, oh, it's time to throw down. It's time to smash machines. And everyone from the 1848 revolution is like, seize the machines. We're going to seize the machinery. And everyone from 1848 is like, that's what we said. Smash it. And there's just a culture difference, a generation gap, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
1802, there's another machine smashing that is not legend. Some folks torched a whole ass factory, doing nearly $1 million of damages in today's money. The owner claimed that an apprentice had held him at gunpoint while his friends burned the place. More power to that kid if it was true, but it probably wasn't. Despite lack of evidence, the kid was arrested, he refused to talk or confess, and he was hanged on his 19th birthday.
Jesus Christ.
Thousands of people came to his funeral.
They loved hanging.
We'll talk about it actually a little bit later. England loved hanging people.
Yeah, yeah.
And he died an early martyr to the war against capitalism.
Yeah.
More sabotage abound, and sometimes workers successfully won things like not taking a pay cut and not being replaced by machines. And this fight for the commons was happening all over the world. It ties into all kinds of struggles. The real MVP tool breakers are the enslaved black people of North America. Enslaved people in the South broke their tools so much that Southern tools weighed three times what Northern tools did because they had to make them so that people couldn't break them.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in 1811, with that comet in the sky, the U.S. saw the largest slave uprising in its history, at least by numbers of participants. The 1811 German Coast Uprising. It had hundreds of folks, including a lot of Maroons, people who were already living free, who were like leaving their Maroon communities to come put their lives on the line, free more people.
Sure.
They marched on New Orleans. It didn't go well. 95 of them died.
I mean, most trips to New Orleans don't go well, right?
Right.
We can all be honest about that. Great city, but...
Yeah. Yeah, but a lot of people die.
A lot of people die there.
Yeah. Yeah. They only killed two white people, and the slavers put their heads on pikes and left them by the side of the road and shit. Full
Wow. Like, well, Roman. That's pre-medieval.
Oh,
that's what,
okay.
I mean, it wasn't heads, but like when the Romans defeated Spartacus's army, they crucified, I mean, presumably, I think it was for miles and miles, like on the road for miles leading to Rome, they just lined it with crucified bodies.
Now tell me how to open a PDF document.
See, I was just thinking, I was like, well, I really like having Robert on because Robert's deep dives of history are slightly temporally and geographically different than mine. Mine
True.
Lean a little bit more towards like Ireland and Norway or like Finland and, you know, Dark Ages, and yours are a little bit more Grecian and Roman.
I absolutely am one of those people who thinks about the ancient Roman Empire every single day of my life.
Yeah. But no, neither of us know how to do anything useful in the modern sense.
Yeah, you yell at Garrison until they fix it.
You can't. Garrison's living in the forest destroying
your
machines.
So now I yell at my roommate.
Oh, okay.
It's true.
He doesn't pay rent. He just fixes my machines when they break every day.
That's not a bad deal.
It's a solid deal, I think.
Yeah. For everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So the same year, 1811, you've also got the Red Sticks, who we've covered a bit in the episode about Negro Fort in Florida. And they are indigenous warriors fighting for their way of life. And it's tied in with this indigenous man named Tecumseh, who was trying to create a pan-tribal alliance to drive out all the white people and reclaim a way of life based on sharing things in common. He talked specifically about this, saying that indigenous folks saw, quote, their lands as common property of the whole. So one white kid who was raised by the Osage at this time saw Tecumseh speak, and later he wrote about it. And he also wrote about the economy of the Osage people at the time. He wrote, quote, all their various products are in general distributed in proportion to the members of each family concerned in their acquirement, though sometimes no distribution takes place, but all draw, as they want, from the supplying source, as a common reservoir, till it is exhausted. Whenever a scarcity prevails, they reciprocally lend, or rather share with each other, their respective stores, till they are all exhausted.
Oh, that seems like a good way to live.
No, I know, right? It's like... Just realizing that, like, a lot of cultures all over the world, including a bunch of European ones, were doing this until capitalism and the enclosure.
It's this thing, you get a lot in American culture and in European culture of, like, idolizing indigenous peoples. And like, no, they were not like angels, right? Like no one is, you know, they had their wars, they had their war crimes. It's just that because of, for a wide variety of reasons, they all tended to embrace the idea that members of a community had responsibilities in common to each other, which is like anathema to large aspects of Western civilization, and particularly American Western civilization. Like, no, you have no responsibilities.
Yeah.
Only to get ahead personally.
Yeah. Yeah, which is wild, because that is where the tension is strongest, right? Because you have...
Yeah.
Down in South America, so the Napoleonic Wars are going on in Europe, right? Napoleon invaded Portugal and Spain in 1808. He installs his brother as the king. This causes a crisis in Latin American colonies, or rather, opportunities for wars of independence. And among the many factions involved in these struggles are groups that were dismissed as hopelessly utopian for like not being moderates, right? And these were groups of indigenous folks, black folks, and European idealists fighting alongside one another to maintain pastoralism and a culture of hunting to defend the fucking commons. You have this First Republic of Venezuela that only lasted from 1811 to 1812, and Simón Bolívar, who is the great liberator of South America. In 1812, he wrote this manifesto where he blames the failure of this republic on, quote, certain worthy visionaries who, conceiving in their minds some ethereal republic, have sought to attain political perfection, assuming the perfectibility of the human race. So.
I'm going to have to mull on that.
Okay. I don't know much about Bolivar much. I only know, like, I have all these, like, holes in my history research that I'm slowly filling, you know?
From what I can tell, he was pretty rad. He was also like a direct inspiration, or at least his image, and it was used by a lot of people who sucked ass. Like,
that makes sense.
Yeah. One of those types. A lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure no right wing people have fought against modernity like the Luddites. and I point out all these people because people tend to view the Luddites as either these hopelessly isolated flash-in-the-pan rebels, or they tend to view them as like the smartest and uniquely best rebels, the only people who could have saved us. The English are the only people who could figure out this whole rebellion thing. But their tactics and some of their ideals came from the colonies, and at least partly, they came from Ireland. Much like all of our sponsors, we are sponsored only by Irish companies. Any of the following accents, you should just assume that they use a leprechaun as their logo.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, drink Guinness. If you have any water in your house, throw it out, block your taps with concrete, and pure Guinness diet.
Yeah.
Breakfast of champions.
Also Guinness water balloons.
Okay.
It's nice out now, you know, with global warming, and the way to keep cool is to fill water balloons up with any alcohol.
I'm just going to go do a marathon with a camelback of Guinness.
Okay, true story. Today, I was trying to look something up. I was looking up something about preparedness, and I was thinking about how hardtack, honey, and liquor are the things that like last forever, right?
Yeah.
And I typed into Google, can you live off of only liquor? And the answer that popped up was the suicide and crisis health hotline.
That's funny.
I was like, I don't even really drink.
Funny. That's good. That's good stuff.
You really don't.
Uh-huh.
No, I drink for ritual purposes. Mm-hmm. That's my current line.
I do. I just do a lot of rituals.
Yeah, no, you're a very spiritual man.
I'm a very spiritual kind of guy. Yeah. One time I had this ritual in San Francisco where we poured two handles of tequila into a camelback and then threw a bunch of lime popsicles in there so it just melted throughout the day. And you could go into stores with a camelback. Nobody notices.
Yeah, totally.
No, I saw this video on TikTok. And I know how to use it. Sorry, olds. Of this person who was going somewhere but didn't want to spend money on expensive drinks. So she brought a glass purse and filled it up with different layers of Jell-O like alcoholic jello in a rainbow.
You have to, no, I'm sorry, you have to stop first at glass purse. Yeah, that, what is I'm a still glass caught up on purse?
That. It's yeah. a, it's so it was like, it was, the, you know, I, sorry, this is.
You don't seem to know how to explain this purse. To us, Sophie.
So it was a bat, it was, so it was made out of glass in the shape of a purse. I will send it to you okay. so you can okay. understand right. what I'm saying. Okay.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It sounds
and
fake,
it's filled with
okay.
jello shots.
It's filled
yeah.
with jello shots, and then they didn't have to pay for drinks the whole night, and it was in the and it was in a rainbow. It was a rainbow gel, alcoholic jello shots.
See, that's
and
what I
was,
used to
and
do.
And I was with them, but then they okay. decided, in order to okay. blend in said beverage, said mm-hmm. beverage thing, so they don't get caught bringing in something like that.
Usually opaque containers would be one's first go-to.
Well, a lot of like bigger places make you bring clear bags.
Oh,
so it was so that okay, was the part okay. they like put regular objects in it to make it look more real, and then they put like fingernail clippers in there, and I was like you lost
I appreciate
me.
The work I and appreciate pen, people putting in the work yeah
I was mm-hmm. I appreciate it too, but you lost me with the fingernail clippers respectfully.
I just had the leather jacket where the pockets went straight into the lining, so I could fit an entire six pack in the lining of my jacket, and I was mm-hmm. a wraith thin 19-year-old, so it didn't affect my silhouette.
I bought from a place in Dublin, actually, River Island. They had this like pirate jacket. It was like a pea coat that was slightly pirate styled enough that like it looked neat, but mm-hmm. not enough that you looked like you were like going to a Ren Fair while wearing it. And I had a friend tear out the lining and replace it with 20 different kinds of pockets made out of 20 different kinds of fabric, including it had two pockets in the back, each of which could fit a handle of liquor. So when I was living in India, you can't take liquor on the subway to get to like parties and stuff. I would just throw a couple of handles in the back of my pirate jacket and yeah. like, yeah, roll on out.
Exactly. And so I hope that all of the ads are for things that will destroy mm-hmm. you, like glass purses and liquor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Here they go.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Yeah. If anyone makes bespoke coats, I miss my old pirate jacket and I don't know where to get a new one. Hit me up.
So in 1798, Ireland had tried to do a rising, and we've mentioned it basically every episode for the past year.
Is this the Fenians?
No, the Fenians are the 1850-ish
yeah, okay.
ones,
so this
I think.
Is, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Although actually, now I'm not actually sure. I think this is a... God, they kept having so many uprisings. This is the one that I mostly remember as the one where the Catholics and the Protestants were 100% were very much together. Mm-hmm. And then after this, the way that it was put down is that the Protestants were given special treatment by the mm-hmm. by the English.
Yeah.
And a ton of Irish people had to emigrate as a result of this failed rising, and a fuck ton of them ended up in these working class towns in northern England. And the Irish had this traditional method of solving certain problems, which is that you send a threatening letter that says, stop the shit or we'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you swear an oath of secrecy and valor to your friends at the pub. You mm-hmm. put on a dress, you paint your face to disguise it, and you go break things or burn things or kill people in the name of these secret societies that have declared allegiance to folkloric and mythic heroes. We covered this most extensively on the Molly Maguire's episodes.
Yeah.
The Ribbon Men are another one of these.
They really had it all figured out.
No, I really did. And that's the Luddite style. Mm-hmm. And so they had King Lud. And if you're going to have a king, it should be a king who doesn't exist. Just mm-hmm. saying.
Absolutely. Tolkien understood this more or less.
I know. This is sort of accidentally the Tolkienist.
Yeah. Tolkienist anarchism, yes.
Yeah. So there's two more side characters I want to cover. The poets. You have William Blake. I love William Blake. My dog Rintraw is named after a character from William Blake. Blake is like Godwin in this proto-anarchist tradition. He is a printmaker who does engravings, and on the side he writes weird fucking theological political tracts and illustrated strange limited edition zines. And read The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, you can't go wrong. He wrote a poem called Jerusalem in 1810, the year before the Luddite Rising, and it's basically about the Luddite Rising, just a year before it happened. It is a poem that is a call to arms to destroy the dark satanic mills and build heaven on earth in England. And it ends with, I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand till we occupy the commons to green and chill our baked lands.
Damn.
Basically, doesn't like factories.
People used to be better at writing. Like yeah. On a per capita basis, good writers are still good writers, but man,
yeah.
yeah.
No, because even like, we'll talk about it a little bit later. Some of the like random working class Luddites also just put out amazing prose. And other ones wrote amazing prose that was like, oi, we're going to kill you, right?
Yeah. It's just, you didn't have a lot else to think about at night other than like, how can I best describe my feelings?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. There's a lot of fermented things and not mm-hmm. a lot of TV.
Yeah.
So the next year, the comet comes to the sky, which the Luddites called a bright flaming sword, and everyone knew it was a comet because they're smart, but it was more than that to them. And let it be Blake's sword that would not sleep in his hand until we occupy the commons. Then you have Percy Shelley. Percy Shelley is in that family of nobility who are like trying to do good. His father's William Godwin, who helped save the life of Tom Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
Percy wrote Ozymandias, which is one of my favorite poems. His wife is way cooler and more interesting than him overall, and she's way better remembered. She's Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein. And Frankenstein comes out in 1818 and is almost certainly inspired by the Luddite Rebellion and the war against machinery in general. At the end of it, the monster says to Frankenstein, "You are my creator, but I am your master." And so my like red strings connecting history board that I keep in my mind at all times is basically like, well, the genre of science fiction exists because of a working class people with hammers and matches who tried to stop the Industrial Revolution.
That actually makes complete sense.
Yeah.
that makes total sense. Yeah.
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 And Percy's all right, or at least super interesting. They're all poly. They're all a polycule and like just kind of
time
fucking
is
each
a flat
other
circle.
Over and like.
I do love how this makes me appreciate the character of Miles O'Brien even more, like a working class Irish union man in the future of space.
Oh, totally. Totally. And so Percy's important part of the story comes after the Luddites, because it's stuff he writes and publishes in 1812. So kind of in the middle of it. And it's a good way to get a sense of what's going on and what impact the Luddites had and some of the ideological framework of the time. Also, he's vegetarian and sober. If you need another XVX hero, there's just way more of them in history than I expected. Mm-hmm. He is super young during all of this, but he dies at 29 in a boating accident. So he really crammed a lot of living into those 3 decades. He's all about the rights of the people and he's all about defending the commons. He wrote a manifesto called Declaration of Rights that starts off, "Government has no rights. It is a delegation from several individuals for the purpose of securing their own." And he goes on to say, "The rights of man are liberty and an equal participation in the commonage of nature." Because, again, the commons.
Man, I love the economy of his word usage.
Totally.
He gets everything that matters and so succinctly.
Yeah, no, totally. And he's a strange poet guy. So the first thing he does when he writes this manifesto is he puts a copy into a bottle and throws it into the sea. And then he takes another one and he puts it in a hot air balloon and like sets it up into the air. But he also publishes it and distributes it.
Based.
And the next year, he writes a poem that becomes, according to author Peter Linebow, the Bible of the working class for the next 2 generations. It's called Queen Maeve, and it gets its name from the female warrior deity from Ireland, Maeve.
Mm-hmm.
It's spelled M-A-B, but I believe it's pronounced Maeve.
Cool.
All the rebels at the time, the smart ones anyway, are tying everything into colonialism. Folks used Queen Maeve to represent indigenous resistance in North America and Ireland, as well as English resistance to the enclosure of the commons. And what's interesting is every now and then I hear people say, and I sometimes find myself saying that the, you know, enclosure of the commons is the English rich colonizing the English poor. But this isn't my interpretation. This is how the English royalty saw their work at the time. There is this asshole John Sinclair, Sir John Sinclair, who wrote in 1803, "Let us not be satisfied with the liberation of Egypt or the subjugation of Malta, but let us subdue Finchley Commons. Let us conquer Hounslow Heath. Let us compel Epping Forest to submit to the yoke of improvement."
Great.
And yeah, it's just colonization. They're just doing it.
Yeah, as they always do. You know, I'm looking at, just read a story the other day about how under Biden, we're looking at like building this AI powered like border monitoring thing to like monitor all movement on the border. And like, yeah, they'll put those in cities if they can, if we let them, you know, if we don't stop them.
Yeah. And the people who claim to care about government overreach are the people who really want them to exist.
Yes. Yes.
So Queen Maeve, this poem, it talks about, it has like prose sections in it. I only read part of it for this, I have to admit. Queen Maeve talks about the labor theory of value, about atheism, about free love, about vegetarianism, and all the revolutionary shit, but like 200 years ago. And his atheism did not stop him from giving a speech in favor of Catholic emancipation as a matter of ending the repression of the Irish people. He very much, he had a lot to say about ending the colonization of Ireland. And Shelley, in this poem, he gets at something that I think best captures the spirit of the Luddites, and this is the most Tolkien thing I'm going to read today. "Power, like a desolating pestilence, pollutes whatever it touches, and obedience, bane of all genius, virtue, freedom, truth, makes slaves of men, and of the human frame, a mechanized automaton."
Wow. Yeah. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a line I think back to a lot, a Charlie Chaplin line from The Great Dictator describing the fascists of his day. But I think about it a lot in context of tech industry people and AI, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts.
Yeah.
You are not machines. You are not cattle.
Yeah, that scene is so good. That is good.
It really is.
When you need a pick-me-up, watch that scene from The Great Dictator and don't think too hard about his personal life.
No.
Or probably...
Even a bad man can channel the mystic from time to time.
Yeah, totally.
Or at least a flawed one, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, flawed people do it.
Aren't we all, yeah. Not that way, ideally, but...
Yeah. So the working class didn't just get its theory from the rich, educated folks on their side. They also were generating it themselves. Among the Luddites were working class scholars. They were like studying ancient Greek when they're coming home from their shifts at the, you know, factory and all of that. And they're studying the modern proto-socialism and the proto-anarchism that's going on. Neither of those words are really doing anything at that point. Mm-hmm. And they're going to do a lot of threatening and fighting and oath swearing. And being really cool. And we'll get to it all on Wednesday. Because that's the Cool People Did Cool Stuff promise, is that the first half is context.
Mm-hmm. And that's my promise to everyone I know about everything any day but Wednesday. I'll get to it Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Wednesday's the day when I do. No, wait, Thursday's the day I do all my work. Mm-hmm. Wait, no, I work all the time. Wait a second. Am I like those people working in the factory?
Sophie, cut the feed. Cut the feed.
I'm just thinking of all the things that I'm waiting for you to do, Robert. I was making a list.
But speaking of things that Robert does, Robert Evans, if you would like to, is your podcast available in English now as well?
It is. It's actually always been available in English. It's just my very strong Bostonian accent is hard for some people to understand.
I see.
But yeah, you can listen to Behind the Bastards every week, Tuesday and Thursday. And you can find my novel, After the Revolution. Just type After the Revolution Evans into Google and it'll come up. Or you can go to atrbook.com and read it on the interwebs for free. But it's also sold all the places that sell books.
Or you'll type it into Google and it'll bring up the crisis hotline.
Yes. It's often necessary for my readers.
And if you want to read more of what I write on Substack every week. I write about preparedness. I write about living in times of crisis. And some of it is free. And then the more personal stuff you have to pay me for. But half of it's free. So what are you complaining about? Sophie, what do you got?
I'd like to plug Cool Zone Media's newest podcast, Better Offline. And just follow at Cool Zone Media because we're going to have a couple additional new shows coming soon. This year.
I'm so excited. I get really sad when I listen to podcasts while I do all the manual work that I like to do and or have to do. And sometimes I run out of Cool Zone Media podcasts for the week and I get sad and I look at other shows and some of them are good.
What if I told you there will be more?
I'll be excited.
Oh, cool.
Just as excited as you'll be on Wednesday when you hear more about the people breaking stuff. Bye.
Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is back. finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.